Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and I'm about to lose my voice for about the third time today. We've done a lot of shows today, and we did a study lesson, and I'm evidently been walking around with walking pneumonia for about a week, but so we're just finally in our throes of recovery, so my voice may start becoming a little raspy before we're done. But we're going to be talking about some of the things we had last week. We talked about our little train series, where you're supposed to get on board with Christ, get on board seeking the kingdom of God. In order to do that, you got to turn around from what you've been doing, because the world's a mess today, because hardly anybody has been seeking the kingdom of God, at least not earnestly. They're constantly getting sidetracked, they're getting distracted, they're getting deceived, they're being led down primrose paths that lead to destruction, and hardly anybody is trying to tell it like it is. Everybody's telling it like they want you to believe it, because they want control over you. They want to manipulate you. They want you contributing to them. They want you listening to them, making them feel better. We live in a very selfish world, and most people are pretty darn selfish. Of course, we're pretty good at putting on a facade of not being selfish. And we always have a certain element of unselfishness in our life. But you think about it, all the criminality, all the breakups in families, all the wars and people in prison, it's all about selfishness. We were just talking the other day about prisons, and we talked this morning again on one of our shows that is studying the Free Church Report. And they were asking, well, in the church there were ecclesiastical courts, are they supposed to have prisons? Well, absolutely not. Why would we have any prisons? We don't need that. And it got into the topic of stoning in the Old Testament. Of course, it is our contention that stoning in the Old Testament never had to do with picking originally, before the language was distorted in Babylonian captivities, etc., where they began to twist the story by twisting the language. The real stoning had nothing to do with picking up rocks. The real altars upon which you laid sacrifice had nothing to do with starting fires and burning up flesh. Did you ever burn up a sheep on a pile of stones? We actually did that once. We had a sheep die of natural causes, and it was an old sheep, and it just died. And it was pretty fresh, so we had this pile of stones. It was actually it wasn't an altar, but it was something that a track hoe had dug out of a hillside on the church property to do a test core sample for rock, for crushing rock, for making driveways and roads on the church property. So we had this pile, and it looked different than all the other rocks because it had been dug out. He'd filled in the hole with other stuff, so there was this pile he just left there. And so we took that sheep up onto the pile, set it up there with all kinds of wood and brush that we had accumulated. We cleared a lot of the brush from that area to open up a gravel pit. And we set it on fire to try to get some video footage of what that looked like, because we knew that that's not really what they were doing 4,000 years ago. That wasn't the purpose of the sacrifices. This is all a distortion and twisting of the language of the time. And that's very bold of us to say, but in reality, we can prove it. Because there's a code in the Hebrew language, because all the letters mean something. All the letters have specific meanings, and you don't even need that. But that verifies and backs up what we're saying. But that is what, when they talk about the sacrifices and kidneys and livers and the rump of rams, They're all talking about something entirely different than what you're imagining, because that's not what the language says. It says something else. And what they're talking about is that the stones of the altar are living people. Even way back then, I mean, they talk about living stones in the New Testament. We are lively stones. But the truth is, the altars of Abraham were living stones. The offerings that they made, when you gave the kidneys of the sheep to the Levites, you weren't giving them the kidney, you were giving them the control of the sacrifice. That's what kidneys mean. The same word for kidneys is the word for reins of control. The same word for a rump is the same word Elijah, a gift of God. The same word for a liver is the same word for honor. And the same word for a gathering of stones is a gathering of friends, of men you trust, of men that you see as honorable and just. That's what a gathering of stones was. Same word. So once you know that, then you realize that the altars where you look out amongst yourselves and find men you trust, you gather them together, but you don't regulate them. You don't hew them with iron chisels. You trust them because you trust them. If you don't trust them, don't give them your sacrifice. And they're to use that sacrifice to take care of the needy of your society, and you bind your entire society together with faith, hope, and charity. And many of you have heard me say this before, but you need to hear it again, because it's hard to stick into your brain. Because you're so used to hearing that they burn up sheep on piles of stone. Now, which makes more sense? What would bind a society of a million people together so that when armies come marching in, they could defeat them in one night like Abraham did? How could they bind such a society together? Because they burn up sheep? Well, anyway, let's talk about that burning up sheep. So we put the sheep up on this pile of wood and sagebrush stalks, which is like wood, big, thick, and it'll get caught fast and burn fast because it's including the roots and everything. And it's all been laying out in the sun drying since we cleared it off. And we set it on fire. And then I was going to do a little talk about this, explaining this in front of this fire as it was going on behind me. But occasionally there was loud explosions coming out of that sheep. It's not a pretty sight, because there is rumen inside that sheep, and the internal organs are full of combustible gases, and as that sheep warms up, things begin to pop. And we're not talking about snap, crackle, pop in a fire. We're talking about serious large pockets of combustible gases exploding, sending parts of entrails flying through the air. So this was what was going to please God, huh? You think so? I don't think so. I think we've been grossly deceived. I think we have been as naive and as stupid as they come to think that that's what was intended. Of course, bizarre rituals like that are really good if you want to start a cult and you want to give people license to do what is wrong and to be lazy and all these other things and not be charitable. Then you can get them doing these bizarre rituals and they'll think, oh, well, we did the bizarre ritual. So that must mean, you know, I mean, tell you the truth, that's what this whole thing with the Eucharist and the bread and the wine, you know, in the church. I used to be an altar boy in a church. As you hold up this little piece of bread and you hold up the wine, you say, hoc est anum corpus meum. The magic words that suddenly turn this bread into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. And I used to pour the water and the wine in for the priest. We had one priest that when we poured in the wine, you kept that little container tipped until every last drop was out in his chalice. And then if you poured in water, he stopped you right away. He didn't want no water in his wine because he was an alcoholic. And he wanted every bit of wine he could get his hands on. And and all these people are paying them money to go through this bizarre ritual. Did you know that the original bread, the Eucharist, that was handed out in the 1st century and 2nd century and 3rd century church was actually sacks of bread to keep your family from starving? And that was called the Eucharist of Christ? It wasn't a little crumb you put on your tongue. But you guys all get into these bizarre rituals and you believe them. But you leave off the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Well, where is the mercy in you getting a wafer of bread on your tongue and sending your neighbor to men who will make slaves of your neighbor and slaves of their children if they need any actual loaf of bread? You see, the Christians could have gone to Rome and got free bread when they had handouts, but they didn't. They divided, rightly divided the bread from house to house amongst themselves. They provided for their own needs because they suddenly realized that this smoke and mirror of this bloody sacrifice in the temple was an abomination. It was an abomination because they had unmoored its purposes from its meaning. And people were just killing sheep. Actually, there was a huge soap factory that they had, and the fat was going, it turned into commercial use. They sold the meat in the shambles. Of course, they did take care of a lot of the poor, but it all became an industry full of thieves and robbers, where the priests were living higher on the hog than the people they were supposed to serve. You know, it's not much different than what it is today. Except you have two sets of priests today. You have the one that's supposed to make you feel good on Sunday, and then you have the others that provide you with your welfare. Your food stamps, your welfare checks, your unemployment. That's all coming from your priests, because that was the role of priests in those pagan temples, to provide you with welfare. Rome used to have temples based on free will offerings, and then they went socialist, and so have you. So anyway, you go back to those sacrifices, and like I said, we were burning up a sheep. I can just absolutely guarantee that killing sheep and setting them on piles of rock and setting them on fire had nothing to do with what God wanted you to do. But if you read those old Bible stories, you see a guy, they got a drawn picture of the altar of stone. Now, they did make figurative altars of stone on which you would bring and offer your sheep. And they would take them, but you can actually see some. We have some pictures on our website, but they're all over the place, where they'd take like 3-4 stones and set them up, and then they'd put a big flat stone on top. And that flat stone on top is like a table that you come and give your offering and it goes over. And if they were giving live sheep, there was one side of the table for the priests and the other side of the table for the people. But the people had to take responsibility for what they gave. If their priests were not doing a good job, don't pay them. Now, what kind of government do you think you would have if you had the choice to say, I don't think you guys are doing a good job today. I'm not paying you. And you could actually do that. Wouldn't that be a difference? I can guarantee that the guys down at the government office would be waiting on you hand and foot when you came in. You go into the clerk's office, they'll be offering you tea and cookies. And they'll be running around waiting on you, because they don't get paid unless they do a good job. They got to make you happy before you leave, or they're not getting no tips. That's the kind of government that God set up. Now, I know a lot of you guys, a lot of people out there in the world, they had a better idea and say, let's get a government with ministers that can exercise authority one over the other. Now, Jesus forbid that. So anybody who's following Christ can't do that. So we know that all the Christians don't do that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people calling themselves Christians that do that. They elect men who can exercise authority and force their neighbors to contribute. They do that. And they become so addicted to it, they can't even hardly imagine a government that you don't do that in. But that's all a rejection of God and a rejection of God's ways and contrary to the name of God. But yet there they do it. And they do it in the name of religion. And I was saying on an earlier show today, you know, some of the most religious people I know are atheists. That's right. Some of the most religious people I know are atheists. It all depends on your definition of religion. You see, there's a number of them out there. Like I said in the show last week, religion defined today is what you think about the superhuman creator of the universe. You know, and I always bring up Hawkins. You know, Hawkins was pressed. He's an atheist. He doesn't believe Hawkins. He's this guy in the wheelchair supposed to be really smart. And he yet does have a good memory for a lot of stuff. But when they were backing him into a corner, asking him questions about, well, don't you believe in intelligent design? All these complexities of the human cell alone can't be just coincidence. And most scientists are beginning to realize that. There has to be some sort of intelligent force moving in the universe to create this DNA system of complex turn-on, turn-off, immune systems, everything else, and be reproducible through something as simple as sex. You can actually make another person that takes the DNA from this person and DNA from that person, who are not even related by any stretch of the imagination, same species, and combine them and make another species. Another of that species. Not another species, but another. And then we talked before about how you can make another species just by changing the electromagnetic pulses in the environment in which another species' eggs are fertilized and hatched. You can actually change fish so that they appear to be a completely different species just by changing the frequency in which those eggs are fertilized and grown. The ones out here operating in the Schumann resident, they look one way. The ones over here operating in this other artificial environment that they create, they look completely different. A whole different set of DNA gets turned on and produces a different fish. And actually, what appears to be a more superior fish. How do you do that? You see, but our existence here on the earth is just a coincidence, a series of chemical reactions that has accidentally happened. So anyway, Hawkins was pressed, like, how can you think that there is no God? How can, and he was being pressed by people who actually are pretty smart guys. So Hawkins was getting backed into this corner, and he says, well, I do believe that there was intelligent intervention in the creation of life on this planet. And they thought, whoa, he's admitting that there's a God. No, he said it was extraterrestrials. People from outer space intervened and altered our DNA and helped create life today because they created some sort of intelligent design so that there were thousands of different species all over the planet, and they don't seem to be common, but yet they have this consistency. And so where did they all come from? Intelligent design. Extraterrestrials. Greys. Or maybe draconians came from little flying saucers and affected our DNA. Everybody was so stunned by his answer that nobody thought to ask him, well, where did the aliens come from? There's no God, there's no superior driving force in life, intelligent force that is, even Luke Skywalker knows there's the force. There's this spiritual force that moves through all things. Yoda said it. So anyway, the point is that we will swallow almost anything. We will believe almost anything if we are desperate enough to believe it. But what makes sense? Strip away everything you've been told. Everything that people have insisted that you believe. I don't insist you believe anything. Strip all that away and ask yourself, what do you think? Do you think there's some sort of intelligent design? You can call them Allah, you can call them God, you can call them Yahweh, you can call them all kinds of things. You don't name them anyway. If there is a God, wouldn't his daddy name him? I mean, Yahweh just means existing one. It wasn't ever meant to be pronounced like any other Hebrew. Hebrew was written to be written. That's why you don't have any vowels. You don't need them. Nobody's going to pronounce it. It's a written language. It's not a spoken language. Now, eventually they learned to speak it. And they developed a whole system where they kind of add sounds so that there will be some kind of vowel there. But in the original language, there is none. It's just consonants. It's the spitting and throat-clearing language, you know, because they don't have vowels. And the mysterious thing is that words are clearly constructed by gathering letters together that have a meaning. Well, you don't do that in Greek. You don't do that in English. You have sounds that represent words. And you may take a word here and a word there and put them together and make a new word. You know, you may put suffixes and prefixes on it to, you know, add an un or a non or the best or the worst, where you add these EST endings to emphasize a particular word or to give it a particular meaning. They did that in Latin, you know, with different words where they would combine words. But in Hebrew, they did it with letters because the words were invented based on gathering the letters together. And this gives you an insight. And if you read the book, Thy Kingdom Come, we go into at least one chapter. We go in and show you an example of that dealing with this sacrifice. But really, why is this important? Because if you don't understand that a free society is bound together by liberty, and how liberty can bind a people together, you're not going to be free. You're just not going to be free. You're going to be gobbled up and gathered up and herded up or just annihilated by one group after another. Because God designed you to be free souls under His authority. How do you even know what He wants? It's back to that still small voice. What do you think? What if there is this divine intelligence working through every living thing, helping maintain order, bringing creation about to survive in the world? You know, consider the lilies of the field. Isn't that same divine creation trying to work through you? Well, certainly it is. It's trying to tell you every day what's good, what's evil. How did they figure out what plants to eat and what plants not to eat? You know, give it to Job. He's dead in the morning. Don't eat it. You know? No, they had a divine inspiration as to what to eat and not to eat. I'm sure there was some trial and error. But they had a certain sense about things. And then they passed that information on. But after a while, the more you learn, the less you depend upon that sixth sense of knowing. Because you're eating only of the tree of knowledge, not of the tree of life. See, I believe that you literally, if you eat of the tree of life, you can find all the answers to the universe. You can invent things that other people have not yet even imagined. Because you will tap into the source, that intelligent design source, and you will begin to see things that others do not see. But in order to tap into that, you need to have the right connection. It's like a computer. You know, is this a 10-pin, 19-pin? What do you need to connect? Well, this is what Christ is telling you. You need this faith, hope, and charity. You need patience. You need forgiveness. You need generosity. You need to come to serve, not to be served. You see, you have to have this unselfish nature. And as you have those things, you're going to be tapping into that source. And you have to believe in that source. And you have to act upon that belief. And this is where I started writing this thing about false religion. Religion used to mean the performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. And now, in just 200 years, you look up the same word in a modern dictionary, and it says religion means what you think about the superhuman creator of the universe, which evidently Hawkins thinks is extraterrestrials. And of course, in a way, he's actually right. Because Jesus Christ is an extraterrestrial. He's not from this planet. He's not originally. You know, but he didn't come necessarily in a flying saucer with a bunch of little grays, you know, coming out, you know, playing. I can't do it because my throat's almost gone. I can't sing anyway. I was going to do the do-do-do-do-do of whatever it is of Close Encounter of the Third Kind. That's not how Jesus got here. So, this divine intelligence, you want to tap into that. You want it to guide you and tell you to step on the brakes and to put on the gas and to go left and get out of town. And what town to go to, what seeds to plant, when and where. And what to read, what to believe when you read something. How do you know that what they're writing to you is telling the truth? How do you know what I'm telling you is telling you the truth? How do you know that God didn't want you to burn up sheep? You know, I tell you the story about the exploding sheep on our pile of rocks. And you say, oh, my goodness, I don't want, that sounds ridiculous. And of course, it is kind of a silly story, but the reason I tell it to you is so you give pause for thought. How in the world was burning up a sheep making God happy? People talk about, oh, it was blood sacrifice. And of course, then we had to have the blood sacrifice of Christ. Well, actually, all sacrifice is blood sacrifice. Unless, of course, you want to sacrifice somebody else's stuff. But even then, that's blood sacrifice, but it's somebody else's blood. Because everything you have is produced by the beat of your heart. Every heartbeat, your blood passes, your life is poured out to get this stuff. These sheep, these goats, these dollar bills. And when you give them up, that's blood sacrifice. Now, people talk about Cain and Abel. Let's touch on that. But we'll touch on that after the break. But then when we get back, we'll talk about the difference between the sacrifice of Cain and the sacrifice of Abel. Did you know those are still going on to this very day? And most people sacrifice like Cain did. That's right. Now they'll tell you this has to do with fruit and it has to do with sheep and all that stuff. And I'll tell you what the symbols mean when we come back to Keys of the Kingdom in a moment.
My name is Mark and I'm from Melbourne in Australia, and I'm a minister in the church established by Jesus Christ more than 2,000 years ago. After reading the books published at hisholychurch.org, I realised that mainstream Christianity had taken a wrong turn by forgetting what Jesus said to do, to practice pure religion while remaining unspotted from the world. What does this mean and how's this done exactly? You'll find out when you go to hisholychurch.org and discover what it truly means to love God and your neighbour as much as yourself. Join the Living Network at hisholychurch.org.
Okay, welcome back. So I tried to get my voice back a little bit more. Someone here just gave me a bottle of kibachi. But she makes it, and thought that might go down good. And actually, it's a little carbonated, natural carbonation. And so we're hoping that it did go down a little bit good. So anyway, you know, we've done a lot of home remedies. I actually haven't missed that much work in this voice thing with just something that popped up today where it started going. I'm supposed to be making promo spots, but I think I'll have to wait till my voice clears up a little bit and gets back to the normal, or people will think I sound like this all the time. But what we were talking about is this sacrifice of Cain and Abel. And I'm not going to fill in all the details. I'm not going to show you all the proofs. But we'll just touch on that just briefly. What was going on then? Because these guys were made from the Adama. And they, that's what Adam and Eve were made from. So somebody reads that he molded the Adama, and we translate it clay, from the primordial slime. And then I guess he poked in a little belly button. Or did Adam and Eve have a belly button? Should they have had a belly button? Maybe they didn't have one. If he made them from clay, why would he put it in there? So anyway, there's a question. You can ponder that. And when you're done with that, we'll try to figure out how many angels can sit on the head of a pin. The point is, they're trying to tell you principles here. Basic concepts of righteousness and unrighteousness. And Cain evidently was not very righteous. There was some serious, problems, social problems, whatever you want to call it. And Abel seemed to have things more together. And so they call Abel a shepherd. And Cain was a tiller of the soil. Tiller of it. They don't use the word for regular dirt. They use that word, Adama, again. And that's where Adam and Eve came from. Adam and Eve were Adama. And somehow or other, God shaped and molded them. But you can interpret that a lot of different ways. Maybe there was already Adama, people, walking around on the earth. It could have been hundreds of them, thousands of them, who knows. But there were only two Adama, Adam and Eve, in which he breathed life. And the rest of the story, we're filling in the blanks. We're drawing the pictures. Now, I know I'm going to get it. I'm supposed to have Kit Ham. Kit Ham is supposed to be on our radio show one of these days. And I love the research that Kit Ham has done. We're also supposed to have Peter Cullingan and several other people. But I love Ken Ham's research. It's really good. It challenges our modern so-called scientists who believe in evolution and follow the Darwin theory, which was really a theory. Even Darwin said it was a theory. He didn't even really believe it himself. But they have expounded on that and created this whole thing that we evolved from this primordial slime. And then people remove the idea of intelligent design entirely. And those are those atheist religionists who've made a religion of their science, and they worship their science as if it is proof, but they're actually more in line with the devil's definition of faith. What there actually is a devil's dictionary. It was printed in 1911 original and has a definition of faith, and it actually is very close to what modern people, modern churches think the definition of faith is, and we discussed that earlier this morning, and maybe we'll get around to it. But back to this idea of what Cain was doing and what Abel was doing. If there were all these other people, and we know that suddenly Cain, when he's going out of the presence of God, he's already killed his brother, and now he's leaving town altogether, he picks up two women in the land of Nod, and marries them. So who are they? Where'd they come from? But the reality is, and that even Adam and Eve, after God breathes life into these two Adama creatures that he has altered slightly, somehow or other, he's altered their DNA, or he's altered whatever, but he took Adama, and he breathed into them, and gave them life, just like Jesus did when he breathed into the apostles and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit." So this is the Spirit of God moved into these people, and they became something different than all the other Adama around them. And they began to operate. And they began to operate according to what God wanted them to do, to dress and keep the garden, to take care of the other living creatures that were all about them, and to guide them according to the dominion of God and the Spirit of God that was now dwelling in them. But they were tempted. They decided not to do things the way God wanted them, tried to decide good and evil for themselves. To begin to, they thought so well of their own ability, they decided they could figure this out. They didn't need God to figure out what they were to do next. And they got into trouble. And Abel and Cain, they were making sacrifices. What was that all about? We're thinking that, oh, Abel's out there, oh, let's burn up some sheep, that'll make God happy. Or was this whole thing of sacrifice, this whole nature of sacrifice? See, when you raise sheep and I raise sheep, you don't carry the field to the sheep. You don't force the sheep to eat. You lead them in a good place where they can get the food and water they need and the shade they need, and they raise their young themselves. They're responsible for raising their lambs and teaching their lambs how to stay together and teaching their lambs how to move together as a flock. That's their job. I'm just supposed to be a shepherd. I don't put them in fenced fields and force them here and force them there and sick dogs on them all the time. I show them the way. And they either go it or they don't. If they don't go it, they may get devoured by coyotes. But Cain was doing something different. See, the sacrifice he received from the sheep that he was guiding was accepted because the nature of the government that he was running. And yeah, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble as a heretic by insinuating. Like I'm telling them, I'm not going to fill in all the gaps of the language and everything. It's actually a real brief story, so you don't really have a lot of clues. Except for you know that the Adam and Eve were to replenish the earth. They had the spirit breathed into them. They were molded from this Adama, which actually has always stood for people. So they were changed. They were different than the regular people. They had an insight the other people didn't have that was given to them, a gift of understanding. And they still blew it. Cain was plowing the Adama. You know how you plow? You take this big, huge steel thing and you cut through the soil, flipping it over and putting it where you want it. He was plowing through the Adama in a straight line, like a bunch of Nazis marching in a straight line, everybody in a row. And he would plant what he wanted to plant and nurture what he wanted to nurture and weed what he wanted to weed. And that the sacrifices that he gleaned from his efforts was not acceptable. These are metaphors for the way in which you conduct your life in relationship to the people around you. Cain ruled with a steel plow, and Abel was a good shepherd. This is the distinction. Now, what are you doing out there in the world today? How do you get your sacrifice to take care of your needy, your widows and orphans? You're going the ways of Cain. We see the ways of Cain when he built his first city-state, and those that followed after him, like Lamech and Nimrod, and eventually Pharaoh and Caesar. You followed in their footsteps. You become a Canaanite, a merchant of men. You've turned your neighbor into a human resource. And your sacrifice is not going to connect you with that divine spark, that yod, that living way, that knowledge. People say that, you know, I've heard people talk about the fact that you can direct, the power in you can direct creation around you. Well, that's absolutely true. But what's the power in you? Where's the source of the power in you? Because there's a lot of power around there. See, in Cain, there was another spirit that entered into Cain, another spirit that entered into Judas Iscariot. There was a spirit that entered into the heart and mind of Pharaoh. So what spirit is breathing in you? What spirit is giving you life? By your fruits you will know. Are you full of forgiveness? Are you full of patience? Are you full of charity? You see, this is why you have to take the wisdom that God gives you, the knowledge of His ways that He gives you, and act upon it. If you do not act upon it, it will not find a home in you. And this is what we were talking about earlier this morning when we were looking at this new article that we have coming out soon. We already have the first part up. The word you use, that word you use, religion. And religion was the performance of your duty to your fellow man and to God, which is to love your fellow man and to exercise dominion in a way that dresses and keeps all of nature, all of that which you have dominion over. You don't really have dominion over your fellow man, but you have a responsibility to him. And we talked about Pufendorf this morning on another show. And Pufendorf, who is he? Most people don't know. You know, did I make that name up? Is that a children's character on Saturday morning at some show? No, Pufendorf was an author about the law. He wrote about the law of nature. And Pufendorf talks about the fact that we are to do no harm to any man. That's one of the first duties we have, to do no harm to any man. And if we do harm to men, we're going to answer the question soon that Cecil B. DeMille asked, which I constantly go back to. I love the question. Are men the property of the state, or are they free souls under God? This battle continues throughout the world today. He asked that at the beginning of the movie Moses, because that's really what Moses was all about. People say, oh, the Bible is about religion. We want to talk about government. What the heck was Moses doing? Moses talked about the sacrifices of God that we want to make in the wilderness rather than what we are doing here in Egypt. Well, what were they doing in Egypt? They made a sacrifice every year. 20% of everything they earned, they gave to the government. The government provided them with welfare. But out in the wilderness, they would have to provide themselves with welfare without forcing the contributions of anybody. And that is the way of Abel. That is the way of Seth. The way of Cain is what they were doing in Egypt, forcing their neighbor to contribute to their welfare through the agency of a government that exercised authority one over the other. That's the way of Cain. That's the way of Nimrod. That's the way of Pharaoh. That's the way that Caesar went. That's the way of Herod. But the way of Jesus and John the Baptist and the prophets was, if you have two coats and your neighbor has none, share. Charity. You see, this is the division. If you follow the one, you will be the property of the state. If you follow the other, you'll be a free soul under God. Now, other things will take place besides those two divisions. You will be connected to an understanding, creative force that is inexhaustible and give you power that other people will not know. But not power to rule over others, power to free others. You see, because we come to serve, not to rule over. We're the good shepherds. But we can heal the sheep. We can leadeth them beside the still waters. Maketh them to lie down in green pastures, where life is abundant. But in order to do that, we have to be willing to give up our own will. Fullness. Let's put it that way. Our own willfulness. And you really don't give up your will. What it is now you will to do things the way of life. The ways of the perfect law of liberty, the way of patience, the way of real faith. And so we don't even, not only do we not know the meaning of the word religion, because the religion in 200 years changed from that performance of your duty to your fellow man to what you think. Faith has done the same thing. The religionists will cling to their personal delusion that they are saved by what they think. That's what they're teaching today. You think you believe in Jesus and you're saved by what they call faith. Unfortunately, faith is another of those words that has changed, that they have changed the meaning of. They have turned it into something else. Now, Jesus was talking about not those who say, but those who do. He didn't say not those who say, but those who think. He said those that do. 200 years ago, this English word faith was also defined as probity. Good faith is the very soul of contracts, it says. Faith is also signifies a confidence or belief, as full faith and credit ought to be given to the act of the magistrate. What magistrate? Is God your magistrate, or have you made some other man your magistrate? You see, there's a rub. Probity, what does that mean? I throw that word out there and then people go like, what'd he say? Probity. Back then it was defined as justice, honesty. This is what faith is. Justice, if someone is not just, if they're not honest, if they are not tending to what Jesus calls the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith, then they have no faith. They have no probity. They're not in love with justice. They may be in love with themselves, but they're not in love with justice. If you see injustice to somebody else, and we've seen some injustice recently in the Monterey area, so we're looking for people in the Monterey area to help out those people. Now, I'm sure we can look in almost every town, but we need to learn how to do this together in one accord, because there's where the real power. See, the power in the kingdom of heaven is in God, and God working through the hearts and minds of everybody you know that also love God. You see, the division of power, they talk about separation of powers in the government of the United States, and they give some power to those magistrates, the division, and they give some power to the Congress to make laws, and they give some power to the executive branch. Well, see, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch in the kingdom of God is within every man. The division of power is the fact that you're separate from him and he's separate from you. And the guy, Joe over here, he's separate from both of you. So what brings you together? So that your power becomes a conduit. It's love for one another. Love for the character of God and for one another. Think of it this way. If I had a little tiny strand of wire, you know, one of those hair-like strands of copper wire, I put one of those strands there, and I tried to shoot 20,000 volts through it, what would happen to it? Poof! Turn to dust. Maybe I make it gold wire. Put 50,000, gold can carry better than copper. Gold wire. Steal that little tiny strand. Poof! Turn to dust. Turn to a white powder dust, which would be colloidal gold. What if I took 1,000 strands, 144,000 strands of gold wire and put 50,000 volts through it? What would happen? You would have a huge source of electricity, a huge source of power. But they have to come together. They have to wrap together. They have to maintain their individuality. You don't want to turn them into a golden rod, because then they're no longer flexible. You keep them, those hair-like wires, but all forming together. That's the kingdom. Each of you is a conduit. Each of you is separate from the other. But each of you must tap into the same source, and you must have the same character of that source, or you can't plug in. You can't plug into that source. You have to have the character of that source. Now, there are other sources out there, but they rob power. They take power. They control. They manipulate. So the fact is, you do have a creative force in you. You do have a power within you, but you want to make sure it's the right power, because the wrong power will devour you. It will destroy you. It will lead you to destruction, because really, ultimately, it don't share power. You know, it's like the rulers in Mordor. They don't share power. They want power. They give you enough power so you go out and do their services, but when they want, they take it all back, because they're interested in control. It is only the character of God that is interested in giving you life, so that you can give life to others, so that he can give you more life. That's why he says, give up your life. Become that conduit of life to others. And this is why we'd like to start through our Living Network, thelivingnetwork.org, gather together, pick contact ministers, pick ministers of record, form congregations of record, like the Three Musketeers, and start working together on these projects, lifting the load with mutual effort, and then start tapping into the inexhaustible source, bringing other people together on board, where you give for the sake of righteousness, to strengthen the poor. If we can start doing that, we will become a conduit for that power that is the creative power of the universe. If we cannot do that, we will remain victims of those who want to plow our lives, plow our children's lives into their soil, turn you into human fodder, human resources for generations to come. Because those are your two choices, Cain or Abel. And you got to remember that they're going to be ruthless. We don't want to be ruthless. We want to be righteous. It doesn't say seek the kingdom of God and his ruthlessness. It says seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness. So that's what we have to do, and we can start in very small ways, in your spare time, and work our way up to the point where we can have that power of God working through us as a people, a peculiar people, because there's not a lot of us out there. But if we are the gold strands, not the aluminum or lead strands, but the golden strands of God's kingdom, we can conduct his power through what we do into others. Because really, this is all taking place on a spiritual realm. We see it manifest in the physical. And you're right, the power can be within you, but you must tap into the right side of the equation, which is a very humble side, very patient, very giving, very forgiving side. Again, I repeat those things because you need to understand, anytime you're not a part of that, you're breaking off your connection. The word sacrifice in the Hebrew comes from a word that means draw near. And that's what you do when you sacrifice your life for the sake of others, for the righteousness sake. You are drawn near. You begin to fit in to that source of power and connect with it in ways you would not be able to do otherwise. You cannot do it through a contrivance. You must do it through humility, but do it you must. Until next week, may peace be upon your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.